The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
It is true that we don't have a system anymore where the government itself has to pay you gold and silver if you want it. It just gives you paper dollars. So it makes it a little easier for the government to borrow money. So we could spend a lot of money on infrastructure. And, you know, that might be good if we have excessive unemployment. But I'm a little skeptical. Modern monetary theory recognizes the inflation problem, but I think it dismisses it too casually.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, a few weeks ago, Dave, we talked about what are interest rates, because to the uninitiated, a person might think of reading a history of interest rates as very, very dry. But actually, the rate of interest worldwide over the last 4,000 years has been a great measure of the drama of human history. Interest rates rise when risks rise. Interest rates fall when risks fall. And so you can actually see the pattern of human history if you just simply look at the pattern of interest rates.
And Richard Silla has added so much to that, whether it's a book on Alexander Hamilton and finance of the period, or the evolution of American economy. He's looked at interest rates from a long-term perspective. I was first introduced to him through a book that he co-wrote with Sidney Homer, A History of Interest Rates. And he is professor emeritus of economics at the Stern School of Business at NYU, and has spent a lot of time thinking and working as an economist. He's done research with the National Bureau of Economic Research and loves to curate. You can tell it not only in the books, but now as chairman of the board of trustees for the Museum of American Finance, which is a Smithsonian affiliate museum there in New York. He loves for people to know what the history has been, and I think also what it tells us about where we may be going.
And we talked 3-4 weeks ago about interest rates in a way are a measure of humility in basically admitting you don't know certainly what the future will bring.
Interest rates tie together the universe of lending in every form and across geographies. So a history of interest rates is by necessity a significant endeavor. It's not only significant to write. If you look at the size of the book, it's also a significant endeavor to read. And as I was explaining to my kids, the intriguing aspect of rates are that they punctuate the stories of innovation and of enterprise and of trade and of migration, of war, of financial market pressures. Interest rates are worth observing, I think, in part because of the drama that they indicate all around them. So to be intrigued by them is to be intrigued by indicators, to be intrigued by signs, to be curious about the clues, which are a part of the ongoing human story, which kind of looks back ancestrally, but also to our heirs, what they will receive from us. There's two men who capture and convey that intrigue with interest rates in their book. And the title of the book is A History of Interest Rates, now in its fourth edition. Sidney Homer, a Solomon Brothers veteran, is no longer with us. Richard Silla joins us today as the co-author of this guide on rates to explore the past of interest rates, the present circumstance, and perhaps the future as well. I'd love to start with the fact, Richard, that you're now on the fourth edition. Between the third and fourth, we had the Cold War come to an end. We had massive improvement in the reduction of capital controls, an increase in international trade. What else can you think of that shifted in that period, 1990s to 2005, when the fourth edition came out, that was important to the discussion of rates?
Well, I think in general, the much-used word globalization was important. We used to have a very segmented world. There was the Western developed countries, which would include Japan. Then there was the communist bloc of countries, principally the Soviet Union and China. And they didn't have a whole lot to do with each other in terms of economics. And then there was the third world, you know, India, Latin America, that wasn't choosing up sides, but just was the third world. Often these countries, I think of India and Latin America in particular, were very restrictive in terms of their economic interactions with the rest of the world. And Then we, you know, had a phase of globalization, which got going, I guess, in the 1980s and picked up steam in the 1990s and really became a big thing in the 2000s, you know, the decade from 2000 before the crisis, anyway, up to 2007-8. So globalization just changed everything. And instead of having these three compartmentalized parts of the world that interacted politically, but much less economically, suddenly, you know, the whole world opened up. You say most of the capital in the world was in the developed countries. A lot of the labor was in the communist bloc, like China in particular, or in the third world, India in particular. And suddenly, you know, the capital of the developed world, the West and Japan, had the whole world opened up to it by globalization, and that had various manifestations. You could invest your, you know, buy securities in the emerging markets, invest in them, maybe set factories there, and that had implications for the United States. We imported more and more from China. Basically, our capital began to use Chinese labor, and that just, you know, was a very different world from the one I grew up in up to the 1980s and 90s.
What does the fifth edition look like? There are things in the 4,000 years of interest rate history which have only now, in the last 5, 10, 15 years, appeared. And so what political, what geopolitical, what social and market-related shifts might get included in a fifth edition?
Well, I think we'd have to talk about, you know, a pretty detailed analysis of what's going on for the last decade or so in terms of the major financial crisis and the reaction of political authorities and central banks to that crisis. I mean, that seems to me the big change of the last 10 years, where we had a major financial crisis, and the way that it was handled was by massive central bank interventions, purchases of government bonds, which central banks always did. But then in the case of the U.S. Federal Reserve, they bought mortgage-backed securities. And I think in Japan, they're buying equities. And the European Central Bank is buying a lot of sovereign debt in Europe. And so that's the big change of recent years. Now, can that continue? Will that keep going on in the future? We started to normalize. The Fed began to increase its rates in 2017 and 18 and reduced the size of its balance sheet. But Europe, which is growing more slowly than the U.S., has continued to have central bank interventions. And Japan, you know, I think the Bank of Japan is now even buying equities in Japan. So we're getting a little out of sync with some of our major trading partners. And I want to see how that plays out. But I told the publishers that, you know, it was much too early to contemplate a new edition of the book because we were in this unusual period, and it would be better when we got a little bit back to normal, assuming we do. That would be the time to evaluate the period we've been through.
There's a famous Austrian economist who once said that the cultural level of a nation is mirrored by its rate of interest. The higher people's intelligence and moral strength, the lower the rate of interest. Does that suggest that we are the most brilliant of any age with the greatest morality in history?
Well, I don't know about the greatest morality in history. We certainly have the highest economic development in history, and that includes financial development. You know, modern financial markets are pretty sophisticated, even though they can have their troubles, as they did a decade ago. You could argue that the level of economic development would say we're at a sort of peak of civilization. I'm not sure about morality. I'm not sure that that has gotten improved all that much more. But, you know, historically, if you look at the sweep of history, and even going back to Babylonia and Greece and Rome, there was a sort of pattern that rates go down, and when those civilizations were at their peaks, they had the lowest rates. And then as they began to decline, you know, we talk about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Well, the rates went down. They were sort of at their lowest in the Augustan age at the beginning of the Common Era. And then they went up as Rome declined. And you see that pattern. It's sort of a U-shaped pattern of rates are high when a civilization first gets going. And then as it improves and reaches its highest level of civilization, rates bottom out. And then as the civilization declines, the rates move up. And that pattern is repeated over the 4,000 years or so of interest rate history that we're able to document to some extent. So what I would say is that our rates are very low now, but you know they're kind of repressed in a way because of these massive central bank interventions that push them way down. And I think they could get back to more normal levels. We cannot talk about what that might be. History is something of a guide there. But I think that we certainly at a peak of economic development in our civilization, and we'll have to see whether we can get through this unusual period and get back to something that looks more like the 4,000 years of previous history.
So you've got the U-shaped pattern, which kind of tells the story of the rise and fall of nations, and that's kind of on a empire-by-empire basis. Yet in the grand sweep of rates, it seems to be something of a shrinking through time. If you look back to ancient Greece, through the medieval and Renaissance period to the present, you could set aside the spikes which have marked, whether it's the end of empire or significant short-term upheaval. How is it that rates changed course so dramatically and defied that downward trend in the 20th century? 20th century, you know, sort of circa 60s, 70s, into the early 80s. Almost on a global basis, significant rise in rates in contrast to that steadily declining trend since ancient Greece.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the 20th century, particularly the period referred to from the mid to late 1960s into the early 1980s, was very unusual. It ended up containing the highest rates in U.S. history. You know, there was, I think, over 20% prime rate, and, you know, the government bond rates got up to 14, 15%, maybe even a little bit above 15%. And, you know, that wasn't so long ago. At least I remember it very clearly. Perhaps you do, too. You know, so that was an extreme of, you know, I would say in my lifetime as an author of a history of interest rates, I've been pretty lucky to have actually observed the highest rates in U.S. history in around 1980-81. And now we're looking at the lowest rates in U.S. history and in some places in the world, not the United States. Rates have even gone negative, which is really an unusual thing that economists had a hard time imagining.
So what are rates supposed to tell us? Remind us of the message implicit in a rate. What is the importance of an interest rate as a signal?
Well, I think the basic economics of it is that it's the financial theory or capital theory, we might call it, is the economics of time. And the interest rate shows you the trade-off between present and future. And, you know, modern financial markets make it possible to transfer money from the future to the present. A good example of that is a home mortgage. You know, a young person getting married, starting a family, doesn't really have enough savings accumulated to buy a house, but they can pledge their future income to paying mortgage payments and thereby transfer money from the future to the present. And the mortgage interest rate represents that. Other people are thinking about retirement when they're not able to work anymore or don't want to work anymore or shouldn't have to work anymore. And they're thinking about transferring income from when they are working to the future when they're not working. So the modern financial system allows people to save now and then draw on those savings later on in life when they retire. So that's a good example. I think those two examples of a mortgage transfers money from the future to the present to enable us to buy a house, and retirement savings and retirement funds allow us to transfer income now to income in the future when we won't be working anymore. So the interest rate is this kind of trade-off between the future and the present.
I thought it was interesting, and this is just, again, the grand sweep of your book starts with the ancient world, Sumerian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian. I thought it was interesting that the credit markets remained underdeveloped in ancient Egypt. It was an authoritarian state. But by contrast, you had very developed credit markets in the Sumerian, Assyrian, and Babylonian cultures. This is where enterprise and free trade were a driving force. Do you have any thoughts on the healthy development of credit markets in particular political contexts?
Well, I think the development of credit markets, of course, is one of the reasons why there's a long-term trend toward lower interest rates, that, you know, the financial development in the modern era, I could think back to the medieval and Renaissance Italians who invented modern banking, to the Dutch Republic of the 17th and 18th centuries when, you know, the full range of modern financial institutions and markets developed. You know, the Dutch had a government debt market, they had a Bank of Amsterdam, a sort of a central bank. They had an equity market. You could buy stock in the Dutch East India Company, Dutch West India Company. And so the Dutch had companies and banks and, in particular, well-developed securities markets for the Republic could borrow money. It actually won its independence from Spain by being able to borrow more money than Spain could at lower rates than Spain could. And then you see the same thing. You know, basically, the English adopted Dutch finance at the end of the 17th and early 18th centuries. The United States, under Alexander Hamilton, duplicated these institutions. And then you see Japan, when it modernized in the 1870s and 80s, they looked at the rest of the world and, you know, they founded a Bank of Japan in 1881, and they had a government debt market in the 1870s and a banking system. And so the civilizations do develop better ways of financing entrepreneurship and financing governments. And I think if you look back into ancient history, I mean, the Greeks and the Romans improved on the Babylonians, and the Romans in particular. You remember the history of interest rates. It studies the full range of interest rates that exist at any time. But the real goal of the book was to say what were the lowest rates that you would observe in any civilization. And the Romans actually got down at the time of Augustus, where people could borrow money at 4%. So the Roman civilization developed pretty good financial markets. And then, as I say, the modern civilizations, from the Italians of the Renaissance to the Dutch to the English to the Americans, the Japanese. And then the 20th century, of course, in our own time, we see these markets being extended all over the world to emerging markets we talk about, and the independent states of the old communist countries. I mean, we're seeing a lot of spread of modern financial technologies throughout the world. The Egyptians apparently did not adopt these technologies to the same extent that the Greeks and the Romans and maybe the Babylonians did. You know, not everybody is equally developed financially.
So when I think of rates, going back to that earlier question and a message implicit in the rate, is it fair to say that an interest rate is an indication of risk?
Well, I think the structure of interest rates tells you about risk. The lowest rates are usually on the safest, least risky assets. And in modern times, we consider that to be government bonds, sovereign debt. And in the case of the U.S. national debt market, which is, you know, probably, well, it is, I think, the largest financial market in the assets of one issuer that's been observed in world history. What do we have, a $21, $22 trillion national debt now? The government, of course, owns part of that, so maybe it's only $15 trillion or so out in the hands of the public. But, you know, that's considered safe, and when there's financial turmoil in the world, people sell riskier assets and buy U.S. government debt, and I guess they buy German debt and French debt and Italian debt as well. So the safest assets in the modern world seem to be these debts issued by sovereign governments, which, you know, in some cases, like the U.S., they have the ability to print their own currency, which seems to make them safe. You know, there's very little default risk as long as the government can print its own currency. So these are the low rates we observe, but then anything that has more risk to it, you know, corporate bonds have a higher yield than government bonds, and stocks, which are riskier still, have higher total returns. And, of course, there are real assets as well, you know, oil in the ground and our housing stock. It has its own level of riskiness to it. So, you know, there's always a structure of interest rates at the lowest rates you can get on the least risky assets. And then there's, you know, the more risk, usually the higher the rate. The risk premium, we call it in economics.
So we look at the risk premium, and obviously with central banks playing a pretty significant role in the markets today, over in Europe we have 14 commercial entities with negative rates, alongside lots of governments, a total of $13 trillion in debt with negative yields, and that's brought that rate structure down across the board, almost a crowding out effect. And I just wonder what the understanding of the market is of maturity risk, of credit quality, and of things like that, when that variable, the interest rate, all of a sudden isn't speaking as loudly as it used to.
Well, that's right. I think the rates are, you know, repressed, or you might even say rigged today by the central banks. You know, they say they're fighting the economic slowdown or recovering from the financial crisis, but they're really pushing rates down to these extremely low levels. And I think, you know, I kind of wonder why people accept them and go along with them. We haven't had negative rates in the U.S., but we had kind of close to zero rates on the short-term stuff a few years ago. I think, you know, we economists need to think this through. Why would people put their money into an asset that has a negative yield? Well, the negative yields are really, in nominal terms, they're really quite low, fractions of a percent. I think it's because, 10 years after the crisis, people still remember the crisis and the difficulties of borrowing money, the drying up of liquidity then. And, you know, that's our short-term memory. It can last a decade. You know, rates were extremely low at the end of the 1930s and beginning of the 1940s in the United States, when people still remembered the Great Depression, and bankers in particular remembered the Great Depression of the 30s, and then they were holding excess reserves. Today, banks have a lot of excess reserves, mostly created by the central bank actions of buying up assets and adding to bank liquidity. But I think, you know, one of the reasons, you know, bankers are, they remember 10 years ago when many of our major institutions, household names, were, you know, in danger of failing, and, you know, people still remember that, and so they're being very cautious. And, you know, I think that can change. It changed certainly from the 1930s and the early 1940s to the post-war development. It may change again, but most people are forecasting slower growth in the future, particularly in the developed countries, than we've had in the past. So that tells me that when interest rates normalize, they may not get back to levels people were used to in the 1950s and 60s.
Now, this again goes back to kind of the older world of Sumeria, Assyria, Babylon. Do you have any thoughts on the sociology of temples playing the role of lender? Do we in the modern era somehow treat central bankers the same? They have a secret knowledge. They have a unique, prescient insight into the future, mathematical wizardry and skills that, again, are almost reflective of the old world of temple lending as you go back to, again, Sumeria and Assyria and Babylon.
Well, I think there were religious reasons for that. You mentioned temples and priests and so on. So people, you know, their religion caused them to support these temples and sometimes put their assets into the temples, donations and things like that. And that's a little different from modern central banking. I mean, we don't rush to give our money to banks, or, you know, we can't really give it directly to the Federal Reserve. But there's not much religious reason attached to it. But there is a sort of mystique of central banking that I think Mark Twain once said the greatest inventions in history were fire, the wheel, and central banking. So that shows you that people pay attention to central banks and think that they're, you know, kind of powerful but sometimes mysterious institutions. And, you know, that's what we've done. And maybe we should think of the modern central banks as equivalent to the Babylonian temples. And in fact, they often build buildings that are very impressive and look almost like temples. There's not much religion attached to it, I think, but there's the same kind of mystique that probably persisted in the past.
You mentioned a moment ago the issue of quality and the top of the structure in terms of risk. The best quality is sovereign debt. Quality is one aspect of a debt instrument. At one point in time, there was no such thing as sovereign debt. There was the merchant. There was an enterprise, and that was considered the best quality credit. Now sovereign debt's at the top of the heap. Could that ever change, where commercial paper is of higher quality than sovereign paper?
Oh, yes. Go back to medieval and early modern Europe. There were, you know, countries with kings usually, and the records show that merchants, you know, who had a kind of mercantile code of honor and fair dealing, they could borrow at lower rates than the kings could, because the kings often defaulted on their debts. And so, you know, it's very clear that a country or a king had to pay a higher rate of interest than merchants who trusted each other charged each other. So certainly sovereign debt has only become the safest of assets in the modern era. And I think that relates a little bit to changes in the monetary system, too. You know, money used to be based on gold and silver. Today, it's something that governments create with the stroke of a pen, unrelated to the amount of gold and silver they have in reserve. And that makes the modern sovereign debt, take a country like the United States. It borrows $22 trillion, and that's what the national debt is now. And people buy and hold that because, you know, it's a promise of the government to pay you in dollars, and the government that created the debt has the ability to create the dollars to pay that debt. We could talk about what those dollars might be worth, and the markets think about that, but they don't seem to be that worried about it of late.
There was a politician in the Midwest, this goes back 30 years or more, and the debate at the time was devaluation of the currency, and one of the questions asked of this politician during a sort of a stump speech was, you know, what about Social Security? Will I get my check? And his answer was, of course you'll get your check. I'm just not sure when it'll buy you. I think that's...
Well, that's the inflation risk. See, I think for some reason, inflation has been under control for the last 10 years. And in the United States, the Federal Reserve is on record as saying that inflation is lower than it wants it to be. That's something we might talk about. But in any case, that's the issue. What will your dollars be worth in the future? Sure, you'll get your dollars. And there are past instances, you know, when people bought government bonds in World War II, you know, prices went up in later decades, and they got back less in purchasing power than they contributed, particularly in the great inflation, we call it, of the late 1960s through the early 1980s, when prices went up at basically 6% a year. The dollars people got who bought government bonds in World War II and in the couple of decades after World War II, those dollars came back to them buying much less than the dollars would buy when they bought the bonds.
On that issue of inflation, this is a novel thing, at least that I'm aware of, but how does a historian such as yourself, an interest rate expert, reflect on central bank inflation targeting as a stated goal?
Well, I'm skeptical of where they state the goal to be. You know, the Federal Reserve, for example, seems to say that we should have 2% inflation, not more than that in the long run and not less than that. And I and people like Paul Volcker, the former head of the Fed, sort of wonder why 2% is a magic number. There is an argument they make, and that's that the economic machinery works a little better. It's like, you know, putting oil in the machinery. If you have 2% inflation, the economy functions a little better. I'm skeptical of that view. You know, we're often victims of our past, and I think when central bankers say we have to have positive inflation today, they're remembering the 1930s when, of course, we did have drastic deflation and economic disaster that went along with it. But, you know, there are other instances in history where economic growth sort of exceeded the monetary growth, and so prices went down gently. The late 19th century in the United States is a good example of that. In other countries as well, in Europe as well, there was a gradual deflation that didn't seem to harm the economic growth of that era so much. In fact, people called it a second industrial revolution. So, you know, inflation targeting, and, you know, I would like to see them target something closer to zero. And in that case, we could say our money will be worth as much if they're successful in keeping inflation around zero. Money 20 or 30 years from now would be worth as much as money today. But if you target the 2% inflation, then money 36 years from now is worth half of what it is today. And any investor, I think, has to say that, you know, that's the goal of central banks. So I know my money is going to be worth half of what it is today, minimum 35 years from now. I have to plan accordingly.
Well, so that fights against the stated goal of price stability. Perhaps they can justify inflation targeting with the second mandate, full employment. So back to rates, as you list in your book, the range of rates studied there is from 10,000% at the upper end to as low as a tenth of 1%. And as I read a recent IMF paper earlier this year, the academic argument was that we've misunderstood the natural rate of interest. And in fact, we can go significantly below the zero bound. The zero is not a limit. We never should have had it as a limit, not in nominal terms. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm skeptical about that. I think we've been through this period of unusually low interest rates and just marginally negative interest rates, and that's made economists think, well, you know, there's no reason why we can't have negative interest rates. But I'm skeptical of this as a long run. I would view the last 10 years of negative interest rates as a bit of an aberration, at least by the measures of all previous history. theoretically, I guess, certainly in real terms, you know, if you have a lot of inflation and low interest rates, you can have deeply negative real interest rates. And I would say our real interest rates, even in the United States, are close to negative now. If you have a 2% yield on a 10-year Treasury bond and the Federal Reserve would be successful in reaching its 2% target, then basically you're getting zero for locking up your money for 10 years or buying that asset that matures in 10 years. So I'm not sure we fully understand the recent period we've been through, which has been very unusual, but it's caused economists to rethink some of their views. And I'm not surprised that some people say, well, we could have negative interest rates, but I don't think there's a strong basis for it in history.
This is your comment is, by the measure of all previous history, this is an aberration. And that's where the avant-garde would say, yes, but perhaps we can throw out all of history. We're in a brave new era. We've always had the possibility of negative real rates. And as you say, we're basically there here in the U.S. And of course, that factors in inflation into the return equation. By present count, there's probably $25 trillion in bonds that fit that category of negative real rates. The new experience is with this negative nominal yield, $13 trillion. And we met in New York in April, and I think it was closer to $10 trillion at that point. Can you walk me through how we continue to expand this universe of negative nominal yields? It certainly seems like we're at the end of a pendulum swing. Am I missing something?
Well, I think the explanation is that, the central banks are buying up a lot of these assets to the point where they have negative yields. And they're also saying, if you, like the Swiss say, if you put money into a Swiss bank, the bank is going to give you back less down the road than you're putting in right now. And that's true for a number of the sovereign debt markets in the European Union. I think it's basically rigged or repressed by the central banks. Why are people putting up with it at all? Because it seems like if you're offering me a negative interest rate, well, I'll just hold cash. I'm not going to put my money in your financial institutions if you're going to give me back less than I'm giving you. But, when you look at the huge size of these sovereign debt markets, not everyone, you and I as individuals could probably drain our bank accounts and get the $100 bills and store them under our mattress or in a safe deposit box. But major corporations and major financial institutions can't do that very easily. So the reason I think we see these nominal interest rates is that the negative nominal interest rates, which are very slight, fractions of 1%, if you try to avoid it by holding cash, well, then you have to have truckloads of cash and storage. And, the total costs of trying to avoid getting a negative interest rate may be greater than the negative interest rate. I also think that government bonds have an option value. I mean, if people went through the financial crisis, in many cases, businesses found they couldn't borrow very easily. And if you have a lot of government bonds, which are considered safe assets, you have good collateral. So even if there's another financial crisis, you will be able to get a loan because you're owning these government bonds. Even if the government bonds are returning you a slightly negative interest rate, there's an option value there that I remember not being able to borrow in 2008, 2009, and that's because I didn't have good collateral, but now government bonds are good collateral, so if I hold a lot of them, even at a slightly negative interest rate, I don't have to worry about not being able to borrow in the future because I'll always be able to collateralize that government debt for a loan.
That's a good point. And we've gotten to these points with negative interest rates using central bank balance sheet power, a little bit more buying power than you and I have as individuals, as you note. It's interesting, too, we've achieved the price of the bond. The price is the opposite part of the equation from the yield. We've achieved the price, which is a record high price in many instances, particularly in Europe. Now the question is, what does it take to maintain that price? Because you have a lot of value tied up at a particular price, at a particular rate structure. You see any normalization, there's an impact to price. And all of a sudden, now what are we talking about in terms of a knock-on effect, potentially deflationary knock-on effect?
Well, yeah, that's the problem. I mean, the negative nominal interest rate of, a quarter of a percent, or I guess it got up to about 2/3 of a percent in Switzerland, that's a small price you pay for having that asset. But, you know, the return you get on your bond is like what you're suggesting, David, is that if the interest rates do go up, well, then the value of the bonds falls in the market. The value of old bonds falls when the interest rate rises. Therefore, you suffer a capital loss. And so your return from holding the asset can be much less than the negative interest rate you were getting. It could be, you know, not a fraction of a percent, but it could be several percent. I look back, you know, history of interest rates, we talk a lot about what happened in the U.S. government debt market in the 60s and 70s, and prices of U.S. government debt came way down when interest rates went up to double digits and, you know, 10, 15%. There were huge capital losses on those bond portfolios. And I think that's a danger which people are not thinking about today. A normalization might push rates up a little bit and the capital losses will be rather minor, but, you know, we could have another bout of inflation like we did in the 1960s and 70s, and that would make holding long-term bonds really a bad thing to do from the point of view of the return you get from holding that asset.
The section dealing with the United States in the 20th century starts by saying, I'm going to read a passage here. During the 20th century, many persons impressed by the success of science in controlling the physical environment have urged the advantages of also controlling the economic environment. The old doctrines of laissez-faire have given ground in most countries of the world and were at times abandoned altogether in some. And then you go on to say, it soon became apparent that controlling an economy, unlike controlling the physical environment, required controlling possibly uncooperative groups of people. Now, this is to my question, because a minute ago you said, well, if you don't like negative rates, you just, you know, we can put money in the mattress and maybe it's not efficient and it takes a lot of space and it's too much space for a safety deposit box. But this is the question. How do you do this? How do you control groups of people and control an economy in peacetime where a tradition of freedom is known or practiced?
I think it's very difficult to do that. You know, we're celebrating the 50 years of the landing of a man on the moon just now in July 2019. And, you know, that kind of shows the control that modern science and modern engineering technologies have. You know, that was a triumph of modern science and engineering to put a man on the moon. But that, you know, that understand, you know, is based on our understanding of physical laws. And now, I think when we're talking about economies made up of, you know, all kinds of groups, producers and consumers, it's not that easy to control. And I think that's one of the things we've sort of learned. Now, we can go too far to the other side. We can say that the government always messes things up, so therefore we should try to keep government as small as possible. That's sort of the neoliberal view. I wouldn't go to that extreme either, but the notion that, you know, on the other side, what we're referring to in that passage is that the people in central banks and government fiscal agents, you know, Congresses, thought, you know, they were told that we can have more control than we probably can, and some mistakes were made. You know, the best example, I hate to keep coming back to it, but I remember it very well, is the inflation of the late 60s and 70s, when the Federal Reserve basically was responsible for it by increasing the money supply. That was based on a faulty theory that if we create more money and trying to lower interest rates, well, the economy will perform better. And in fact, what happened, instead of the economy performing better, price levels just went up even to double-digit levels by the end of the 1970s. So I think we've learned lessons that, you know, controlling an economy by pulling levers at the Federal Reserve or in Congress and spending fiscal measures, it's not as easy as putting a man on the moon.
I grew up in a family where we talked about this kind of stuff routinely. What are some of the probable outcomes of putting too much debt into the system? Today, we have quantities of debt which continue to grow, private, corporate, governmental, credit growth being one of the keys to economic growth. Would you anticipate at some point some sort of an explicit default, maybe a sector-specific explicit default? Or how would you weigh the probabilities of the more implicit inflationary default?
Well, I think the inflationary default the implicit default, as you call it. That's a good way of putting it. You're not really technically defaulting. What you're doing, though, is giving people much less than they expected by inflating the currency and paying back in cheap dollars what people invested when the dollars were more valuable. So that, I think, would be a major worry. And, of course, people worried when the central bank started to do these quantitative easing measures, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, that it would cause inflation. It's an interesting issue why we haven't had more inflation given the amount of central bank interventions. And I think one of the reasons is that, you know, a lot of the currency central banks created, or the money they created, was held on the balance sheets of banks. You know, excess reserves went from, they used to be, you know, 50 to 100 billion, and they went up to 2.5 to 3 trillion as the central banks were creating this liquidity. And there was a potential for inflation there, but for some reason, the banks, I think it's because they were shell-shocked a bit from the crisis, they held those excess reserves. Normalization would say, well, the banks want to get back in the business of banking. They don't want to hold a lot of excess reserves. They want to make loans to businesses. That's what banks are supposed to do. And consumers, for buying cars and buying houses, that's what the business of banking is about. And I think it becomes inflationary when the amount of credit increases faster than the monetary authorities would like and prices begin to rise. And there, of course, the Federal Reserve thinks it can control that by paying interest to the banks on reserves. You know, that's kind of a new tool of monetary policy. The Federal Reserve pays interest on reserves to the banks. And so if it doesn't want J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America or whatever to lend more money to us, it raises the rate it pays them, which induces the banks to hold those reserves instead of lending them to you and me. I don't know if it's the greatest innovation in monetary control history. It seems to transfer money to the banks, and politically that could have problems. If the banks start lending more money to the private sector, there's an inflationary potential there. We haven't seen it for the last 10 years, but I think it's lurking there in the shadows and might come out into the sunlight in the years ahead.
I think one of the things that I love about reading your book, Richard, is that 10 years is a very small period of time in the scope of interest rate history. So what's happened in the last 10 years, there may have been some meaningful events, but in the context of 4,000 years, you need to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we say in the book and document is that there are sort of interest rate cycles of, I would say, maybe even 20 to 40 years. You know, from the late 19th century on, interest rates went down, let's say, from 1870, not long after the Civil War, to around 1900. That's about 30 years. Then they rose to 1920, and that was 20 years. And then they fell from 1920 to 1946. That's 25 years. They rose from 46 to 81. That's another 35 years, I guess. And now we've had, I guess, the most recent lows in our interest rates were 2016 from the highs of 1981. So that is what? That's another 35 years. So there's interest rate cycles. I think people should keep that in mind. You know, it's not, interest rates don't go straight down or straight up. They fluctuate a lot. So if you think there's an interest rate cycle of 20 to 40 years, 10 years really is a very small part of interest rate history.
What that suggests, too, is that this bull market in bonds is not atypical. Starting in 1981, in the fourth edition, you mentioned that maybe there's the end of that bull market cycle in 2003. Well, we can amend that. Maybe 2016 with the 10-year Treasury getting to 1.3.
Yeah, I have to admit, that's a mistake I made. You know, because what happened was the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates from, I guess, mid to late 2003 and 2004, 2005, you know, and going up 25 basis points at every meeting of the Federal Reserve. So rates went up from like 1% to 5.25% or something like that. And then, of course, the financial crisis hit and the rates came down as they did. But when I was working on that fourth edition back in 2004 and 2005, I noticed that the average rate of a 10-year Treasury bond was about 3.33% in May of 2003. And it was substantially higher when I was looking at that. So knowing this cyclical behavior of interest rates, it looked to me like we might be moving back toward more normal rates from the low rates we had after the collapse of the dot-com bubble. But of course, what I didn't foresee, and I suspect many others didn't foresee, was the major financial crisis that was going to befall us starting in 2007 and continuing through into 2009. So we didn't foresee the financial crisis, and then we didn't foresee how central bankers would respond to it. Today, that 3.33% on the 10-year Treasury bond looks pretty good, but I think it's more like 2.1% now. That definitely made a mistake there.
Here's something that's also difficult to predict, and yet it's here. We have the political will to perpetuate a business cycle. And I think perhaps an overconfidence of gerrymandering with rates, suppressing them, pushing them lower in order to perpetuate a business cycle trend. So again, these are experiments in control, which may be unique to the 20th or 21st century. Is this an experiment in control where economic outcomes, I mean, how far do you think they can take that? 2016, present, we're kind of waiting for a turn in interest rates if we are thinking of them having a cyclical nature, but also different, perhaps this time, is the political will to make it different this time.
The central bankers certainly think that they can control things, and you know, there's some controversies about central banks. Not everyone likes the central banks, but I think that's part of the political will, allowing the central bankers to use their judgment to control our financial economy, and by that try to control the real economy. And I think they can feel pretty good that, you know, what we've had now, and we're talking about a 10-year economic expansion in the U.S. since the 2009, and a sort of a record length expansion. I noticed, so in the 1990s, we had a long expansion. In the 1980s, we had a long expansion. In the 1960s, we had a long expansion. I think some of this is not due to control so much, but it's due to the changing nature of our economy. We were once an agricultural economy, then we were an industrial economy, and now we're a post-industrial economy where really a small portion of the labor force makes things. I mean, mostly we perform services for each other. And I think a service economy is inherently more stable than an economy that has industrial production where, you know, people, the automobile dealers make a lot of cars, and then people stop buying cars, so they lay off their workers and so on. We used to have business cycles of 3 to 4 years, and now we have these long economic expansions of a decade or so. So I think, while, you know, the central bankers may like to pat themselves on the back for making the world more stable, I think it has to do with the underlying economy they're dealing with as much or more than their own expertise in stabilizing things.
That's a great point. Yeah, I wonder, with the change not only towards the service economy and, as you say, being in a post-industrial economy, information and computation, these are things which today are vital. And I wonder if information and computational power create a context for lower rates over a longer period of time. You chart the influence of information transparency, peace, financial sophistication, all of these things being contributing factors to kind of that broad sweep of lowering rates from the 13th century to the 20th century particularly. Have we gotten to the point where information, let's even call it big data, and computational power can in fact keep rates lower for a longer period?
I think that's a possibility. Certainly, I'm impressed by the amount of information that's at your fingertips now when you have a smartphone. And then, of course, we have our laptop computers and the internet. I mean, it's so much easier to gather information on investments or just about anything else. I don't know, you know, my wife and I talk to each other and we sometimes have a question about something and we say, well, we don't, you know, let's just get on the iPhone and check it. And often you can get an answer like that. So what that tells me is that we really are in a pretty sophisticated, advanced economy now, and some of the computing power, it's made our lives easier. It may not have increased the GDP all that much, but it certainly made us more productive, and therefore, I think we are in a sort of new informational revolution. A lot of people have talked about that. I think back, you know, when I was young, 50, 60 years ago, everything was totally different. You didn't have cell phones. You didn't have, you know, calculators that you could hold in your hand and do things. And today, you know, the person, I was at a conference not so long ago, and a professor there was talking about the cost of a supercomputer. And as recently as the 1980s, you know, it was $25 or $35 million. Then he pulled out his iPhone and said, you know, this thing that you can buy for $1,000 or less has about as much computing power as those supercomputers that cost $35 million did, you know, in the 1980s. So we live in a very different world now than even when I remember earlier in life.
So let's talk about something that's being proposed as being different in this world. There's a popular conversation among politicians, even a few academics, proposing the idea that you can spend what you want. Deficits don't matter so long as the debt issued is in your own currency. Welcome to modern monetary theory. As a professor of history of financial institutions and markets at NYU, and as the past president of the Economic History Association, what say you to these new ideas of unbound spending and unlimited political promises?
Yeah, I don't think it's totally so new. I mean, the what is sometimes called modern monetary theory is basically money printing, and you know, we use money printing to finance the American Revolution, and some of the colonies before we became an independent country issued fiat currencies, you know, state bills of credit. In some cases, these worked all right because the colonial economies were in fact growing very rapidly at 3 or 4% a year. We know that because the population growth alone was around 3% a year. So they needed more money, and the British, you know, one of our gripes against the British was they didn't allow us to have our own money system. They wanted us to be on gold and silver. In particular, they wanted to drain us of our gold and silver. So we invented, you know, paper money to get around that, and the British cracked down on the paper money too. So anyway, modern monetary theory or money printing is certainly not new. The question is, will it cause inflation? And I guess the modern monetary theorists say that, well, if the U.S. government can borrow money at a low risk, and investors should buy it because the government can print the dollars that to repay the money it borrowed. The question is, what would be the impact of that on the price level? So I don't think modern monetary theory is really all that new. It just raises some of the issues that we saw previously in history. And I'm a bit skeptical about it, but, you know, it is true that we don't have a system anymore where the government itself has to pay you gold and silver if you want it. It just gives you paper dollars. So it makes it a little easier for the government to borrow money. And the idea is the government, you know, let's say we need to fix our infrastructure in this country. Our roads are bumpy and our bridges are falling down and our airports are third world, some people say. So we could spend a lot of money on infrastructure. And, you know, that might be good if we, in fact, have unemployment, you know, excessive unemployment. But I'm a little skeptical. The inflation, modern monetary theory recognizes the inflation problem, but I think it dismisses it too casually.
Confidence seems to be right there. We were talking about a unit of account. Does it maintain itself as a store of value? And perhaps you can print and print and print until that moment where confidence all of a sudden shifts. Again, in the 4,000 years of rates being a part of your history in this equation, has there ever been a time, as you look back at that history, when the scale of debt didn't matter?
Oh, I think it always mattered, but I mean, it matters much more. You know, in the modern world, there's much more credit than there was. It's one of the distinguishing features of our modern world is that credit flows much more easily, and it's partly due to modern financial technologies. It's partly due to the fact that more people are richer, and so they have more, let's say, discretionary funds to invest. But I think the amount of credit always mattered, you know, and there were defaults too. There were defaults throughout the 4,000 years of history, and you know, usually the defaults caused the problems. So, but the scale of modern financial markets and modern financial institutions is unprecedented. We didn't see anything like that before our own era.
Takes me back to one of your earlier comments, which is perhaps we've reached an economic development peak. We'll see, and time will tell. I have two more questions for you before we wrap up. And one of them is just where do we go from here? We've had a bull market in most financial assets, which has been aided by the lowest rates in recorded history. As an academic, or even as a betting man, where do rates go from here, and what is the impact to asset prices?
Well, I've been expecting them to normalize for a few years now. And, of course, we started toward normalization, I think, starting in 2016-17 with the Fed raising its rates and reducing its balance sheet. And I'm still waiting for that normalization to occur. But, you know, as of right now, I think the characteristic of the long expansion of the last 10 years from the lows of the recession of 2007 to 2009 and the stock market bottom, and I think it was March 2009, we've had this long expansion and asset prices especially have expanded a lot. And I think that has a lot to do with the unprecedented low level of interest rates. My own view is that the stock market, especially in the United States, is a bit overvalued. And as interest rates move up, what I would say is that the outlook for stock market returns, you know, which have been 6 to 7% real in the 20th century and maybe the early 21st century and maybe closer to 9 or 10% nominal, I don't think from today's levels we should expect those kind of returns based on the kind of slower economy that we have now. And part of the reason as interest rates move up, I think, you know, debt assets will look a little more attractive relative to equity assets. And so my view is the outlook for stock market returns isn't really all that great from today's levels. But of course, you don't want to have a lot of bonds either if your interest rates are going to move up particularly rapidly, because then you can suffer those capital losses that'll give you a low or even negative return. So I think, you know, this is one of the, we should be glad that the central bank interventions, which have produced these low interest rates, have avoided a Great Depression or even recessions, but we shouldn't be very happy about our low rate of economic growth and some of the inequalities that seem to come up along with that, too. You know, there's a lot of worry about the 1% or the 0.1% getting most of the gains from what growth we have. So I think that's related also to very low interest rates. The top income earners and top wealth holders tend to have most of the financial assets, and so low interest rates have certainly given them great gains. They haven't done a lot for retirees living on fixed incomes. In fact, low interest rates have reduced those fixed incomes. So there, you know, we have some problems to sort out here.
So if you had to choose an allocation appropriate to the times, you mentioned some things to avoid. Obviously, bonds are vulnerable. Stocks may underperform. Still, a balanced portfolio is probably going to have some exposure to both. But what do you want to own? What do you want to own? You've got 4,000 years of history in your back pocket and maybe two quarters in your front pocket. What do you do with those?
You know, I think the asset allocation kind of depends on where you are in the life cycle. Based on my own experience, you know, if you're a younger person, maybe even less than 50 years old, history would suggest that, you know, if you're 20 years away from retiring or more, probably you should hold mostly equities, even at today's prices, because, you know, the history will show that 10 or 20 years later, you will probably have done better than you would with anything else. But for if you're older, you know, let's say 50 or above, if you're eligible to be a member of the American Association of Retired Persons, you want to be a little more cautious. So I think there, you know, just looking at today's market, well, there's some dangers in holding long-term bonds, and equities are unlikely to give you great returns. So I would say there you want to hold, you know, maybe shorter-term debt and what people call value stocks, ones that pay a pretty good dividend yield and have a low price-earnings ratio. And so but short-term bonds, I think, would make sense in today's environment, because there's this risk in long-term bonds. If rates do normalize or go up to more than normal, like they did in the 1970s, you can get waxed if you're holding long-term bonds. So I think, you know, value stocks and short-term bond investments would be my recommendation for people 20 years or less from retirement.
You know, looking back at various financial panics, there was just in the 19th century a significant one in 1825, one that kind of spanned the globe in 1857, and people would get out of securities, stocks and bonds, and move into cash. Now, cash in that era was the same thing as gold. Gold's now, you know, a cheap commodity, two-bit, nobody cares about it. Did people move in the next crisis with some of these loaded issues of lots of debt, likelihood of inflating the burden of that debt away? Do people move to cash with the same energy that you might expect, or does gold have a play as a liquidity store?
Well, I think, you know, if we're going to have a lot of inflation like we had in the 1970s, there's an argument you can make for having some gold in your portfolio or, you know, basically hard assets. If there is an inflation risk, and I think there's probably more than most people think today that there'll be more inflation down the road, just because inflation has been low for 10 years doesn't mean that it can't pop up again. It has periodically in U.S. history, especially during war times, and then even in relative peacetime of the 1970s, there's an inflation risk there, and gold tends to do well when there's, you know, it's a store of value. It's been that for a long time, and of course, its price is up quite a bit from the old, you know, in the beginning of the U.S., the dollar was defined as about 1/20th of an ounce of gold, and then President Roosevelt in the 1930s changed it to 1/35th of an ounce of gold. But now, today, an ounce of gold goes not for $35, but for what, $1,300, $1,400. And so that kind of shows you that gold is a bit of an inflation hedge in the long run. I think the point is that if there is an inflation risk, real assets are something that one should probably pay more attention to. Land, houses, precious metals, you know, something that's real, that, you know, because what is inflation after all? It's just a rise in the prices of the things that we normally see in front of us, or the houses we live in and the land we walk on. People aren't worried much about inflation now, but if there is an inflation risk out there, and I think real assets, precious metals being one, are something that's a little bit safer than owning stocks and bonds.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for academics like you and Mr. Homer, who condensed a universe of information into one tome. It's not only a great resource tool, but I mean, I think my kids thought I was a little crazy. I told them I was reading this like I was reading a thriller, because there's so much packed into the history of interest rates. The storylines, that what is implicit and what is between the lines, is absolutely fascinating. So I thank you for the years that you've put into creating this book and updating it. And when the fifth edition comes out, I'll be one of the first buyers. Thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome, David. It was a great pleasure to converse with you today.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.